It's time for Eco Talk with host Betsy Rosenberg.
She'll be great. She's a very smart, capable person who knows exactly what took place and will lay out the facts. And that's what the American people want to see.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
And welcome to Eco Talk. As always, an ostrich-free zone. And on today's programs, we have five green gals and one green guy. What a lucky guy. All sharing with us their insights into living in this modern world while at the same time becoming closer to the earth that sustains us. First, Jill Bamberg's up. She's Dean of Bainbridge Graduate Institute. She'll be discussing her new book, Growing to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out. In our second half, we'll talk vodka with Square One Vodka founder and CEO Allison Evanot about how much fun it is to run a company that parties with principle. And finally, our higher education correspondent Shauna Weber will join us. She'll be speaking with the dean of Yale's Environmental Studies program, Gus Speth, one of the people who inspires me most. He is quite articulate and quite compelling in his comments, mostly about global warming, and worth listening to. Want to recognize one of our partners, EcoTalk, proud to be sponsored in part by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a science-based nonprofit combining independent research and citizen action to achieve innovative solutions for a healthy environment and a safer world. On the web at ucsusa.org, and you can find us on the web, by the way, at www.ecotalk.net. You can find free audio archives that you can download at your leisure. Well, first up, we're going to check in with Jill Bamberg, who's joining us in the Green Studios in San Francisco for all these recent green events. She is a former software industry maven with a Stanford MBA who traded in her money-driven career to teach social responsibility in business. I'd say that's a real good way to recycle yourself. She is Dean of Bainbridge, as we mentioned. It's a graduate institute which has an environmental focus, and they're offering an MBA program, in fact, on sustainable business. Her book is Growing to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out. It argues that if a company remains true to their mission, big doesn't necessarily have to mean bad. Welcome to EcoTalk. And some of the companies that come to mind first, the traditional green ones, if we can call the last 10 years a tradition, Tom's of Maine, Ben & Jerry's, Body Shop, Stonyfield Farms, Clif Bar, they're all socially responsible businesses. Now, not all of them did sell out to bigger corporations, but Tom's and Ben and Jerry's did. Maybe something about those first names, as well as Body Shop. You say that's not necessary, and yet it is a trend. So why are they doing it, and why do you feel it's not necessarily a good thing?
Well, good questions. Those are actually the questions that triggered my whole investigation here. And I think they did it. Each of the stories is slightly different, and so they all had their own different reasons for selling to larger companies. But I don't think it's inevitable. And what their sales did for me was actually trigger a research project that was a couple of years of interviewing about 30 different businesses who haven't sold out, but who are able to get to a significant size and impact in the world without either selling out their values or selling the interest in their company to a larger firm. So that was the gist of the research project.
And I know at Stonyfield, I know Gary Hirschberg is still involved in the day-to-day management of the company. And is that true for the other ones as well?
No, not necessarily. Anita Roddick is completely out of the Body Shop at this point.
Ben and Jerry's,
I think they're both gone. The only one where the founder is still involved actually is Clif Bar, and they have remained independent, and that's an important story too.
They did not say, and we had the CEO, Cheryl Loughlin, on, actually. And
right.
Gary's been on in a couple of years ago. He was on my other program talking about how he came so close to selling that they had the buyers in the room, and he, I guess, had a panic attack or something and excused himself and walked around the block and came back and said, sorry,
right,
not doing it.
Right. And he was able to stay independent. And the companies that I interviewed for the book were also able to stay independent. And in part, it was because they had made some intelligent decisions at the very beginning that maybe escaped the notice of some of the other folks.
So is this just a function of getting bigger that you're bound to attract the attention of one of the big guys?
Well, I think for sure you're bound to attract their attention, but your ability to resist their offer is what's the critical issue. And the companies that I looked at were able to make it on their own. Other companies sell out for a variety of reasons. It may be that the early investors want to get their money out of the firm. It may be that the founder is ready to retire. But there's a lot of talk in this particular business sector about the so-called legacy problem, which is how, once you do actually get out of the business or need to sell for one reason or another, how do you preserve the values that led you to found the firm in the begin with after your ownership passes?
Now, you use the term sellout. Do you mean that in a literal sense, or do you think they really sold out their values?
Well, I think they were unable to guarantee that the values that they founded their companies with would in fact continue after they sold, because they no longer had a controlling interest in the firm, and so someone else was going to make future decisions about how that would go, and they couldn't guarantee that the decisions would go in the same direction they might have had.
Now, you have an MBA from Stanford and 7 years of working in the computer software industry. How does that experience and your profit-driven background, as you called it, affect your teaching now as you really educate a whole new generation of business owners of tomorrow?
Right. Well, I'm actually in a very interesting situation where I'm the dean of a business school that is all about sustainable business, which is both environmentally sound and socially responsible. There's really two important legs of that whole business. And many of my students come in with an idealistic background and a desire to change the world, but their business skills may be a little bit weak. So one of the first things I have to teach is that the profit is not a four-letter word, that it's actually important and that it's a necessary ingredient to fuel the kind of business growth that's going to enable businesses to change the world. So that's one way in which it influences it. And I don't think that profit is a dirty word, but I think it needs to be placed in the service of broader ideals. And that was true for the companies that I interviewed in the book, and that's what mission-driven business is really all about.
Your book is called Getting to Scale. In what sense do you mean getting to scale?
Well, what I was fascinated with was whether or not there was some sort of a glass ceiling that mission-driven businesses hit that forced them to sell out. So getting to scale simply means getting to a size, in this case, getting to a size that has two characteristics. One is the business is able to continue to thrive, flourish, and compete successfully. And the other is that it's able to get to a size where it can have the impact that's desired on the outside world. And scale is a relative term. It's not a single destination, and it varies from one company to the next, one owner to the next, and one industry to the next. But the idea is that you can achieve a significant size and impact without selling out your values.
Mm. And it must be an exciting time to be writing this book and promoting it, because it's an exciting time to be green and to be a potential green business owner, because there's so much interest suddenly, almost overnight. When you started this book, did you know that it was going to, the environment was going to be so hot, literally and otherwise?
Right. Well, unfortunately about that, no. I think this was just a topic that I have been obsessed with since I saw the sale of these first businesses. What's interesting now is in the nonprofit world in particular, people have had a number of successful social experiments, and they're anxious to extend the benefits of those and the impact of those social experiments, and everyone is sort of alive with the discussion of how can we bring these things to scale and put them out to a larger group. And I wasn't expecting it to come on quite as strong as it has.
At the Green Business Conference, I was fortunate enough to get to interview for the keynote address Gerald Perlman, who told his story of starting Organic Bouquet, which was the first organic flower company in the States, and amazing pitfalls. And, you know, he had problems, you know, finding suppliers and getting consumers to be interested, vendors, and yet he has an $8 million a year business now. I mean, grown exponentially. So that's where the excitement comes, is don't necessarily go out and look for a green job, but look to create a green business, a green career. There's so much opportunity in what is, you know, really a bunch of environmental problems.
Right. Yeah, my whole pitch to students is we basically have to reinvent the way in which we do everything now, because the planet won't support us continuing to do things the way that we have. And if that isn't the biggest business opportunity in the history of the world, I can't imagine what it is.
That's why I keep telling my husband, there's job security, honey. Every day that the news gets worse, that's going to be good news for EcoTalk.
Right, exactly.
You practice sustainability. You preach sustainability, you got to practice it. But I think it's really shifting. I mean, just this year's Green Business Conference and Green Fest, the mood is even more energetic and more enthusiastic, as green suddenly really has entered the mainstream. I don't even think it's entering it. I think it's really, at least it feels that way on the coast. I don't know if it's like that in the middle of the country.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm fortunate enough to live on the coast. I live up in Seattle area. So.
But, you know, it's okay you have to start somewhere. And that's why we do a lot of California-centric stories here and even maybe Bay Area. But I justify that by saying, you know, if others can learn, and it's not just all happening here, and there's many green pockets around the rest of the country, Madison, Wisconsin, and there are other places out there that are doing amazing things. But, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Let's learn what others are doing. Let's read a book like this so, you know, future green business owners can learn about the pitfalls.
Right. And I mean, one of the things that was most interesting to me was that these kinds of businesses, which are running, being mission-driven and values-based, I found in every single sector that I looked, and I deliberately tried to cast a broad net. So it was broad geographically, but more importantly, it was broad from an industry perspective. And every single industry, I found people who were willing and able to run businesses with a mission beyond making money.
Getting to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out. I hope you can find that at bookstores everywhere. The author is Jill Bamberg. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for your important work and contribution to this growing ecological movement. May it grow. May it spread. May it happen now.
Amen.
We'll be back right after these messages.